This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 38.
Altitude.
Tower, 2-6 release you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire protector.
I'm speaking to my friend, my program curve was at 354.
What's that?
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Viper 1 targeted.
My guest today is Russ Prechtel, callsign Cranky. He's a former Viper test pilot. He's seen and done a few things. Up on the Afterburn Podcast website and the afterburnpodcast.com, I put up a link to one of his videos where he put the F-16 into an unrecoverable spin. So check that out. He's flown the B-17, the MiG-21, probably 36 aircraft. Quite an impressive resume. Enjoyed talking with him today, and I think you'll enjoy hearing some of his stories. Before we do, just a few admin notes. As always, I'd like to thank all my Patreon supporters, as well as everyone who's just taking the time to swing over to iTunes and drop a rating or review. That helps the podcast out. For those who heard me talk about Patreon, not really sure what it's about, it's a way to support the podcast. This is just a short clip of a There I Was story from Cranky. This is his There I Was story. It lives up on patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. Each guest typically just leaves a 5 to 15 minute There I Was story. And this is just a snippet from Cranky's.
I was over Egyptian airspace and the tanker said, okay, I'm out of here. Good luck. And so... This F-16 did not have GPS. It was Block 40, but an Egyptian Block 40 at the time didn't have GPS. So I had my INS, which now after 4.5 hours had drifted quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I didn't exactly know where I was. So it was interesting. So first thing, you know, fighter pilot, shiny objects. And I look down and go, the Great Pyramids. So what else do you do when you're over the Great Pyramids? You turn inverted and you look at it from being inverted, right?
Naturally.
That's what you do.
So again, that's a segment from There I Was, where most participants just leave a short story that stands alone, something they tell in the bar. And if you're looking to support the podcast and are looking for more content, you can swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. With that being said, let's get into the episode with Cranky.
Sir, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Happy to have you on. Quite a distinguished career. Looking forward to hearing about it. I always ask my guests to kind of give the 60 to 90 second elevator pitch of where they started and what they're doing today, and then we'll dig into your career from there.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Rain. I'm Russ Prechtel, call signs Cranky. I went to pilot training out of college, Air Force ROTC. Went to pilot training at Willie, had a wonderful time there. Got my first choice F-16s out of Willie. went through leading fighter training, Holloman, as we did back then, and then off to MacDill for RTU, which was 6 months at the time. Got my first choice out of there to Toromon. I wanted to go to Toromon because I heard they did a lot of flying and I would get to see all Europe, and that both those were true. And I went to Toromon, and their primary mission was nuclear strike, secondary of conventional air to ground and tertiary of air to air. So lots of diverse missions for the multi-role F-16, but getting certified for nuclear strike was certainly very sobering duty, to have to sit alert and be ready to jump in the airplane and ready to go within 15 minutes when you're sitting alert. And other than that, we had some amazing times. I spent 8 months in Incirlik, a couple months in Aviano, a couple months back in the States for flags, red flag, green flag, that type of thing. And a lot of flying all over the place, across countries through Europe, flying around Spain. It was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it. And I know, joking about it, the fact that Willie, MacDill, and then Toromon, quite different than my Mississippi, South Georgia, South Carolina. So all the good ones, it seems like they've closed down.
Yeah, so one good thing about those other basins is that you would actually get to fly in weather and get some actual weather experience, whereas at Willie, if we never had any weather. And those of us who came from Willie had no IMC experience, which is interesting, because when we showed up at our first base, Toromon, we weren't exactly welcome for a variety of reasons. One was no weather experience, of course. The other one was we had just killed two lieutenants through GLOC before I showed up, and about the Viper and how quickly it can put some G's on you. And I learned that firsthand, actually. I had a GLOC while I was there, but jeez, they were very careful with us, cautious with us. They even sent all the centrifuge in Amsterdam to really work on our G tolerance. Because two lieutenants had been killed, they were not so happy about having lieutenants. And as Hilt said, they're a bunch of old Vietnam fighter pilots. So, you know, they weren't all fluffy and politically correct about it either.
Yeah.
Along the lines of say hello, the new guy, you know how that
yeah,
goes.
Yeah. I can only imagine that, you know, GLOC, I don't know how many guys have been killed in the Viper, but I think the Taiwanese might've had the last one 2 or 3 years ago out at Luke with the GLOC. Now having a GCAS, auto ground collision avoidance system, yep. I had a buddy saved by it. There's been several saves of it. And that's one of the videos I need to throw up on YouTube, because the unclassed version of the, I think it's a Tucson B Corps student where he's asleep, supersonic, pointed at the ground. He should have been a smoking hole in the ground, but having that technology saved his life. So it's really, man, it's some great tech that's incorporated into the Viper. And a lot of the foreign military sales, FMS countries, have had that for quite some time. But it's taken till 2015, I think, for most of the U.S. inventory to have that.
It's amazing how long that stuff takes. I actually tested it in the Viper in the 90s at Edwards.
Really?
And it's great capability. And I found myself, there I was, doing, I think it was a 2B1 ACT at Toromon as a lieutenant. And you know how it goes. You get to the merge and you don't see the guide. And I can't remember if we had GCI helping us or what, but at the last moment I see him down there. And of course, instinct catches in and I'm like, you know, yeah, I'm on him, right?
Yeah.
And
time to kill.
And the HUD video tells the rest of the story. So yeah. I didn't strain like you're supposed to. And I just put 8+ G's on the airplane. And in the HUD video, you see it. You see the air, you see me saying, I got him. And I'm going into my 8+ G, slice back. And then the G's go back to like 1. And the airplane's just sitting there, you know, like this. And then I wake up and I re-engage and go after the guy. And I had no recollection, right? I had no recollection of any of that. We get back, we're watching the HUD video, and my flight commander was my flight lead that day. And he's like, what the hell's this? You lost consciousness. Do you remember this? I'm like, no, I don't. So now, you know, the flashing alarm bells of the squadron commander and OPSO were like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Wow, this is bad, because we almost lost this guy too. And fortunately, I was, you know, up 15,000 to 20,000 feet. So I had time to time to wake up and get my act together before, you know, anything bad happened. So the auto GCAS, it's a good capability. It's amazing how long it takes to get out to all the airplanes.
Yeah, I mean, it would have saved if so many lives have we had it sooner. Having it is awesome, but there's a lot there to like just dig through. One, like the debrief, the fact that it's so important in the fighter pilot world, is so important in any world, really, you can make that justification. But had you not had that debrief, wouldn't have caught it, and you might have gone out there the next day and done the exact same thing with a different outcome. And I can remember, I think I was number two in a four-ship night ride, and watching everyone's HUD tapes, you see number four in his HUD tape, who is pointing at the ground, pointing at the sky, pointing at the ground, completely disoriented, and had no idea until we did the debrief. Just watching his tape, it was clear that he was spatially disoriented and had no idea. Fortunately, he was in the mid-teens, and the outcome didn't end tragically, but it can just go sideways so fast.
Absolutely.
Gosh. Yeah. And now, you know, you mentioned the old Vietnam fighter pilots of your day. I think with the new G suit, the ATAGs, it's supposed to give you an extra G and a half of protection. Mm-hmm. The big concern, at least especially when I was going through the B course, was doing a counter hob, so counter high off bore sight maneuver. So you're fighting someone who has an AIM 9X equivalent, meaning they can shoot you across the circle, for those who are listening and don't understand. But you have to min range that as fast as you can, which requires basically a split S type maneuver, which is just high G, you know, mil power or AB for part of the maneuver. Like you can put yourself to sleep really quickly. And the fear was that guys and gals were just going to be relying upon that ATACs. That fear is still there. I had four G suit blowouts in the demo profile, right? So slightly different, but it's very high G intensive, which would, you know, comparable to that counter Hobbs maneuver. So pointing at the ground, pulling nine G's, not where you want to be when you have a G suit explode or you're not on your G string.
Yeah. 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 And stuff happens fast. As you know, high speeds, high G's, dynamic situations. One other thing that's kind of fun is all the time we spend at Insulet, sometimes we do these exercises and I think Bilt's did a little good job of explaining it last week. You know, we would work our way up. We'd be doing a conventional engagement against the adversary, and then things would escalate to the nuclear exchange. And so what that ends up looking like is a bunch of F-16s loaded with nuclear weapons, and then the inspectors come in and they inspect. Did you load your nuclear weapon correctly, right? You know, they look paperwork, they look bomb, all that stuff. So we're out there doing our exercise, and this was, I don't know, 2-3 weeks after Libyan bombing in 1986.
Okay.
So just to put you, we were working on adversaries like Libya, and in the middle of the night in Turkey, a couple Libyans jumped the fence into our nuclear exercise and got within feet of real nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I imagine that went over really well.
Not really.
Jeez.
Yeah. So obviously security was a little lax. Stop the exercise at that point, obviously, because they had bigger problems to deal with. But that was kind of memorable that we had Libyans jumping our fence during that exercise.
That's crazy. And I mean, now I just think of I've flown some places that have nuclear weapons. But even flying over them is prohibited. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of security. We've had a few faux pas in the Air Force, I think, over the last decade or so with nuclear weapons and maybe flying them to places they weren't intended to go to or they thought they were training munitions. But there's a lot of detail that goes into it. You can attest to it, sit in that nuclear mission. So I would like to just talk about that a little bit. What was kind of the mentality back then? What was your thought process? Because I imagine it had to be a pretty high stress just getting certified. And then when it's actually time and you're sitting alert, knowing the power that you have or the responsibility you have, that had to weigh on you a little bit, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was very sobering reality to be sitting alert and knowing that if the alarm goes off, that you're going. And they would scramble us, if I remember correctly, if we were there for a 10-day pad tour, as we called it. We get scrambled at least two times, maybe three. And they were always exercised, right? We never went to war. But you never knew that at the time. And so when that klaxon goes off, you got to scramble out to your jet, get in it, get started up as soon as you can. And they'd ready for the message. And they'd read you the message and decode it. And, you know, you're just hoping that it says exercise and not actual. And, yeah. And the real reality is that if I thought about it, if I was actually flying that black line or mission, that doing it for real, that, you know, wasn't just me, it was the whole world was erupting into a global war. And that's the only way it could justify is, you know, they were coming to attack my family and my loved ones back home. And I was defending the United States of America. And that's what you do. But it was nonetheless very sobering, and knowing just how close you'd be to your own detonation and other detonations like the out there ones. It was, like I said, very sobering. It's always funny because I'd be out there one day in an exercise that way, tab B, you know, airplanes to the tab B, and talk to the crew chief while we're waiting to get started. And we talk about the mission, and he goes, yeah, if you guys all launch on this thing for real, I'm just going to this tab B and closing the doors. I said something along the lines of, son, there's probably already a very large missile on its way in here, and that's not going to help you at all.
Right. I mean, the Russians or the Soviets, you know, they knew where nuclear was being launched from. Not a good. No one wins in that scenario. That's for sure.
If the Libyans knew where we were, I'm pretty sure the Soviets did too.
Touche, touche. Yeah. Oh, well, it sounds like, I mean, obviously that assignment, the weight that it carried with, if you had to actually go out there and do the mission, wasn't a lot of fun, but it sounds like the assignment in itself, just living in Europe, was a pretty good time. Right. Someone had to do it, you know, so thanks for your service there.
Yeah, we had some really good times, and he'll cover the 1B many in the 50-mile circle after doing simulated play. That was a lot of fun. You can get away with that today. And things like that were fun, but one of the most memorable things we did was we did a dive into our industry. So our wing, the 401st Tactical Fighter Wing, and our squadrons were B-17s in World War II, and they were based at an airfield in the UK called Deanthorpe.
Okay.
And so partway through my tour, we went there and visited, and it was a really great mission. We really went back into the history. We even named our airplanes after B-17s from the war. And the folks in the town of Deanthorpe were wonderful hosts. They took us around the old closed air base, and BBC interviewed us. It was really a really nice time. It was the first part of our, you know, just a great cross-country weekend. I think we landed at either Alconbury or Mildenhall, and we went to Ramstein after that and Thunder Bay. So those types of cross-country were just phenomenal. You know, I look back on that now, and it's like, wow, how lucky I was to be able to just fly around all these countries in an F-16, no less.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, it's different today. Just the dogfighting, you know, in Europe, and being able to just jump and go fight anyone in the airspace, like, just doesn't happen that way anymore. It would be pretty amazing.
Yeah, you had to be careful because you get jumped just being on the cross country. And if you have a 3G travel pod, well, that's too bad.
Clubbing baby seals out there, that's what that becomes.
Yeah, right.
So after Torhone, you go to Luke, and now you're teaching guys and gals how to fly the F-16. What was your Luke assignment like?
It was good. You know, we had some interesting times. You know, getting really good at teaching basics to dogfighting and dropping bombs to new pilots. And I found myself, I got much better at the basics doing it. I did enjoy that aspect of it. I enjoyed helping turn out new fighter pilots, and some of which I still know and work with, as a matter of fact. I taught academics. I created courseware that was kind of interesting. Getting to run off to Nellis to do red flags every now and then was a lot of fun. Some memorable DACT with Tomcats in Miramar on a Wednesday night. good times there. So some really good opportunities, but got really good at doing the, hey, common student error, this is what you can do wrong in this sortie, go out and do it, come back and show them and go. So he did that common error. So try not to do that one again. But it was good. It was a lot of fun.
What was it like fighting a Tomcat? I think that'd be a lot of fun to do.
Well, you know, they got a big old radar missile that shoots you from a long ways away. So, we said, okay, they'll take their Fox One shots, but we'll continue to merge for fun.
Yeah.
And of course it was fun. You know, that Tomcats aren't very maneuverable against the Viper. You know, fought F4s too, kind of same thing, you know, previous generation, and it turned very well.
Yeah. So I fought, some F-35s with my buddy. So it was two ship of Vipers, two ship of F-35s. We split the airspace and we fight, just doing close stuff. Right. I mean, it's the same deal as like the F-35. It sees you a long way away. It kills you. But you know, if you go fight close in, it was like clubbing a baby seal. But at the end of it, I just kind of followed trail on him. We go rejoin my wingman, who's completely unaware that we're there. So he's like, and that's the point of it. And so like, touche, touche, you know,
that's funny.
But test pilot school comes after Luke.
Yep.
So did you always want to be a test pilot, or was that just kind of something after flying the Viper for a few years, you said, hey, you know what? I'm going to apply and try to go be a test pilot.
Yeah. You know, like a lot of kids my age, watched, Neil Armstrong walk on the moon, thought it'd be great to, you know, go fly in space. We thought we would be having a really big space program. So it was that type of thing. So it seemed like being a test pilot would be a way to get there. So that's what guided me initially. I went through the test pilot school at Edwards. And it was a hard year, as you probably heard from other people. It's a lot of academics, report writing. The flying, of course, was amazing. I got to fly, 34 different planes, including the B-17 and the, MiG-21.
Okay.
And those were phenomenal to be able to fly those. And, after going through the school, I, got my choice to stay at Edwards and went down the street to the F-16 combined test force and, tested F-16s for 3 years. And that was amazing. That was just phenomenal to be able to fly, you know, like a Block 50 arm targeting system test mission in the morning, and then do some, proficiency BFM in a small tail A model in the afternoon. Those airplanes, all of them were just amazing, but everything in between, weapons, software, propulsion, everything, you know, so I did get to do just about everything while I was there, which was really enjoyable.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I'm curious as a pilot. So I know everyone goes through test pilot school. They fly a myriad of aircraft, but when it comes to like flying like a MiG-21, how much prep goes into it? Like, do you know at the end of the week, I'm gonna fly a MiG-21. Here's the things to start it, don't kill me, and how to land it. Like, how much, you know, cause there's no simulators. So what does that cycle look like?
That's a great question, Rain. So all of test pilot school is kind of, the curriculum is all architected to force you to prioritize.
Okay.
And nothing's more important than being ready to fly that airplane, so you don't do something inadvisable, as they say. And so they loaded us up with all sorts of reports to write and academics to study, in addition to getting ready for your flight. So you always had to know how to prioritize, and flying was obviously the priority. And so when you find you're going to fly this plane tomorrow sometimes, or 2 days from now, you get out the flight manual and you go through it and you study the important stuff. Takeoff speed, landing speed, stall speed, best glide speed, you know, critical action procedures for, you know, that airplane, you know, what do you do if you lose an engine on takeoff type thing? Similar to the Viper, right? The one similarity with all these airplanes is that, you know, once you get them out of the chocks, everything's really cool. But, you know, a lot of times getting these airplanes out of the chocks, you know, just imagine, you know, did you fly the analog Flickus F-16?
No, I've only had, buddies. I've heard the stories, you know, I'm used to this, the Flickus bit and
yes,
magic.
Digital Flickus is very nice, but the analog Flickus in the Block 10s and Block 15s was, it was some work, but I tell you, that was nothing compared to General Dynamics' previous airplane, the F-111. I flew that thing and doing the flight control check was that was, you know, you're holding one arm back here on some switch and you're moving the stick with your right hand. It made the F-16A model Flickus look easy by comparison. But, you know, that airplane was tough to get out of the chocks. And a lot of them were because you've never flown them before. It's your first time. But then you get up and away and flying it, and it's very enjoyable with a couple exceptions. Exceptions, some really bad flying airplanes that, what we would do is we'd be tasked to evaluate each airplane for its mission. How well does it do its mission? And so you'd write a report based on that. And so I most of them were amazing airplanes, do their mission really well. And then there's always some exceptions.
Yeah, no doubt. Was there like a, is there a MiG-21 SME or a subject matter expert for those again listening that would, if you're trying to get that plane out of the chocks, B-17 probably a little bit different. I imagine you might have a examiner or something like that who's rated on the B-17 to help there a little bit. But if you're sitting in a single engine plane or single seat cockpit, is there someone there that can help you through that process? Or if you're flying around as a supervisor flying up in the tower, do they have the checklist to back you up to walk you through that plane?
Yeah, there's always an instructor who's knowledgeable on that plane. For the MiG-21, I sat in the cockpit after reading the manual. I sat in the cockpit and the instructor just sat there on the ladder and we went through everything for a while. It was a Soviet MiG, so It still had Cyrillic on all the controls and a couple of key ones like fuel pump had an English label on them taped over it. So he talked me through it, and actually that was a two-seater. So he hopped in the back and we did that, out of Pax River, that one. We were on a field trip. So that was memorable, and it flew just the way they told us it would. I can't imagine why we wouldn't know that ahead of time, but
strange
how that happens.
Now, so you mentioned obviously that you got some favorites and not so favorite aircraft going through and flying 34 airplanes in test pilot school. I imagine had to be a lot of fun, a lot of stress, as you mentioned, but what was like the standout, like best airplane you flew going through TPS?
The best flying airplane out of all those was the F-18.
Okay.
Canadians came down for about a week with their F-18, F-5, T-33 aircraft, and we got to fly them all. And F-18 was just an absolute dream. It flies, its flying qualities are superior. And this is an old F-18B model, not the Super Hornet or Growler, but the kind of lightweight analog to the F-16. And it flew about as nicely as the F-16 flew. So that was a real fun airplane to fly.
That's awesome. Can you speak to the Vista at all? I'm not very smart, but was that around when you were going through TPS?
It was. Yeah. So one unique airplane that was highly modified. Vista stands for variable stability, and you can dial it up to fly any way you like. And so also, Calspan was the company who also had a T-33 same capability. So in test pilot school, I got to fly the T-33, and so you could change the gains of the flight control system so it could handle like a fighter or a cargo plane. And just by the flick of a switch, you could completely change the control laws. You know, just imagine a lot more stick force, for example, helps it fly like a cargo plane. It's not hard to do. Like I got a Tesla, I just hit a couple buttons and it does the same thing. It goes from sports car to Cadillac.
Yeah. I guess for me, thinking about it, something different sitting on the ground or something attached to the ground when you change how it performs versus, an F-16 that looks a little bit different and you change up the flight control logic.
It's really valuable for training pilots on how different airplanes fly and doing research on those airplanes. Before it became the full up variable stability airplane, it was also the multi-axis thrust vectoring F-16, MATB.
Okay.
And so it had paddles that went into the exhaust nozzle to help vector the thrust. And that was, again, a one-off research project, but it was there when I was there. And so I chased the MATB F-16 through a lot of missions. And it does a lot of really tight turns like the F-22 does today in its air show. So that was neat, but it probably added too much weight and complexity and cost for it to be something that they would production on. So it didn't go anywhere, and they took the M-ATV off the airplane, and to this day, I think they still fly that same airplane as the Vista.
I guess the genesis of that, or the thought process behind it, was to do thrust vectoring on the F-16, or is it to help develop and do thrust vectoring on the Raptor?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And I think it was more for the F-16. Okay. I think it was a research project specifically for the F-16.
I imagine what I remember of it. Thrust vectoring, you probably could paint yourself into a corner on the Viper, I'd imagine. You know, the Raptor is just like magic to me.
You know, what we learned way back in our old ACMI exchanges, we go to like Dutchie Romano or Nellis and, you know, many engagements. We learned pretty early on that if you turn more than 30 degrees and try to tie it up with somebody, you're going to die. Somebody that you're not watching from outside the turn circle is just going to nail you with the missile, and you won't even know. And so we would die. We would learn that in these exercises. And the next day we go out there and go, I'm turning 30 degrees, taking a shot, and I'm blowing through in full AB, you know? Some things never change, right?
Yeah, no, it's 100% valid, you know? We get so focused on the core, which you got to have those, you know, the part task trainers build the monkey skills there, left hand, right hand, to go out there and fight. But
it's fun to dogfight. Everybody knows that. Yeah. So, you know, we still wrap it up because it's fun.
Yep, no doubt, no doubt. The some things as a test pilot, that again, we kind of mentioned before this, you know, coming from the SEED world, the Suppression of Enemy Air Defenses, the HARM, High Speed Anti-Radiation Missile, so a lot of acronyms here, that was the bread and butter of the Block 50 mission, is the bread and butter of the Block 50 mission still today. But you had a couple tests, you know, doing the first data link HARM shot. So can you walk me through kind of the evolution of that? Because that's a big player today. And what does it mean for today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was one of the first Block 50 tapes that we were testing. I think it was 50T1, actually, first one. And there were a lot of new things on there. And HARM targeting system had been developed previous to that as a separate project. And so I started flying those HARM targeting system missions, and they were a lot of work in a single seat aircraft, to be honest. You know, if you're having to cycle between several displays, one of which of course is your HARM targeting display as you're looking at the surface to air missiles lighting you up, or emulators that light you up. As well as your air-to-air radar warning receiver, you know, navigation, flying the airplane. You know, it's very, very busy mission. And at the time, I was coming up on 3,000 hours in Viper, and I was very proficient. And I realized that this was a very, very busy mission, even for somebody who's very proficient. So knowing all that and knowing how complex the mission could be, We tried to develop something that was relatively straightforward, so we could just test the data link capability. And what they wanted to do was launch a HARM just based on their data link shot. And so what we did was we set up a SA-6 emulator at China Lake on their range there, which is, you know, easily within flying distance at Edwards. And my wingman, Evan Thomas, had another Block 50 F-16 with the HARM targeting system on it. And I didn't have a HARM targeting system. I just had the HARM. And so what he would do is he'd be flying in an ellipse, actually physically separated from me several miles. I couldn't even see him. and he would ring in the threat, and then he'd data link it to me. It'd show up on my display, and we did a rehearsal mission for it. But the day of the launch, everything worked. I was cleared to fire, and I let that beauty go. After having shot some air-to-air missiles, I was expecting something similar to the air-to-air missile, but knowing how much bigger the HARM missile is, I figured it'd be a bigger boom, and it was really big. I mean, big, just like a big bomb coming off the airplane. You know, the airplane reacts when something that big comes off, but it flew up and actually in front of the airplane and straight up in front of my hood, and then I flew through the through the plume, and that was kind of interesting. ECS didn't really agree with that, but it was really neat watching the, as far as I can see it, watching it fly up to hit its target. And because it's flight test, we had video of separation from the airplane. We have video of the impact. So it was really neat to see it all come together and work well.
Yeah, it's, you know, the constant iterations and the improvements and bringing technology to the forefront to help the fighter pilot out is huge. You know, when I left the F-16, 7.1 was the tape. There's new ATD attack display, which then through, you get the radar picture, you get the HARM targeting, so you can get ground threats as well as navigation on one screen. Still, it's resolution limited. I know they're working through a lot of things and upgrades that go into it, but there's so many sensors that you're cycling through. The day you were winning is when you had a bomb, a HARM, and an air-to-air missile all in the air at the same time. But it's a lot. I mean, you're managing a lot of sensors to make all that happen.
That is a lot.
Yeah, but, you know, if you do that, then you're a champion. So every now and then.
Mm-hmm. It was fun doing that and evaluating new capabilities that could help the warfighter, you know, do their job better. The HARM targeting system is one of them. Decoys were another one. And so June of 1996, Scott O'Grady got shot down near Bosnia. Scott was one of my students at Luke, as a matter of fact. So I knew Scott. And so what we were tasked to do was take the decoys that were in development at the time and basically deploy, get them fielded. And even back then, the 90s, that was unheard of. You know, usually it's years and years of development testing, operational testing, fielding plans, then fielding. And we all did that in a single digit number of weeks. And we are still testing the first decoys on the F-16. And soon enough, I found myself in Aviano giving the pilots academics on how the decoys work, how to load them, how to fly with them. And so that was very interesting, but it was very, very rewarding to be able to bring that capability to warfighters that quickly, right from development.
Yeah, war sometimes drives the necessity. And normally, I know that timeline was very compressed, but developmental tests, normally you'd be out there flying with it, finding the parameters, making sure it's not going to damage the aircraft or do something crazy. And then operational tests would take it and figure out how to employ it. But it sounds like the timeline there drove basically to, hey, this is how to operate. Maybe some, hey, this is what we figure out might work tactically, and then give it to the unit for them to hone it. Or was developmental test, I mean, operational tests involved in the process at all?
They were involved. When we got the order to accelerate, we did a joint development operational test to get there. And so if I remember correctly, they came to Edwards, where we had all the hardware, and they flew some missions there, and we had been flying it for a long time. So we were already, going through evolutions of, oh, this one breaks every time you do a 3G turn, it comes off, and, you know, that type of thing. So a lot of that had already been done, but we were still in development. So it was just a very accelerated, capability.
Yeah, the story I have from that is like my last deployment with the targeting pod and actually being able to generate much more refined coordinates than we believe. They tried to knock us down to Cat 3, and we said, actually, in these parameters, we can get Cat 1, and able to do a white paper on it, and weapons officer got it approved. And, you know, it showed that, hey, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, we actually can drop nail drivers and hit whatever you want. So again, going to combat and doing the war thing can sometimes speed things up just a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
So the rest test there, you shared a video, which I'll share on the website, mm-hmm. but it's you in a flat spin in an F-16, which is something that's rather non-standard. Can you kind of talk me through that mission, what drove to it, and then mm-hmm. what was going through? It's a wild video. Again, I'll throw it up on the Afterburn podcast website, link it over to your page there, because it's wild.
It is wild. Watching it now, showing it to people, it still brings back the adrenaline from the moment. But the idea here was, in flight tests, you never have enough time or money to test everything. And so what we do is we decide to take selected points in the envelope and test them. And this way, if you go test something that is at the worst part of the envelope and it clears, then you don't have to necessarily test so much in the middle of the envelope. And so we had a new digital flight control system, OFP, that we were asked to test. And this is for the Block 40 and 50 aircraft. And it was kind of the same thing. It's like, okay, well, we're going to, we don't have the money, so we're gonna fly with a bunch of stores. And we think that we can clear these configurations for Cat 1 operations. And so it's actually that photo right there. Targeting pod, centerline tank, two AMRAMs on one wing, no AMRAMs on the other, and two Lau 88s without bombs. That was the configuration that they wanted to clear for Cat 1 operations. And so there's a team of us, and we are kind of working up to that configuration. And so one of the pilots who's flying at Dan Levin was flying that configuration, but with a nav pod, and I was chasing him the week prior. And I noticed he was starting to get into some post-stall gyration, some yaw movement after he departs. And really, for the vast majority of F-16s, if you deep stall it, it's going to self-recover. The nose is pretty heavy, and it'll just fall down and self-recover. But what we would do in flight test is we would create the worst conditions. So we would get an AFCG by running all our fuel out of front tanks first. And we'd run the airplane out of airspeed, typically by going 60 degrees nose up and just running it out. And even when you do that, you can get it back into controlled flight within one or two pitch rocks. You know, you're at 60 AOA, and within one or two of these pitch rocks, you're back down, you're flying. It's great. So then we goes up there, and you know, I see it's taking him a couple pitch rocks, but he gets it back out. But we do see that this post-stall gyrations, yaw rate, starting to develop. So it's my turn in the chute the next week. And, you know, they said, look, you know, if you get some of these yaw rates, what we might try and do is if you pitch rock and nothing's happening, we may have you just hold full forward stick and try to dampen the dynamics, the oscillations. And in the video, you can hear my test conductor saying hold at some point. If that doesn't happen, we start these at 35,000 feet, and that gives you 10,000 feet to play with. So you're trying to get back under control. You got 10,000 feet. You get to 25,000 feet, you got to pop the spin chute. That's our spin chute safety deploy altitude. And that's no messing around. You got to do that. If that doesn't work, because we did have one time the spin chute didn't work. So she'd both like, okay, that doesn't work. You don't want to punch out right away, because if you're at a yaw rate and you punch out, Kemp is going to take your head off. Okay. So that's kind of a known problem. So what you might want to do is you can jettison that satellite tank. And when you get down to the thicker air, maybe you can pitch rock a little bit more. But once you get down to 10,000 AGL, you got to punch out. So I'm thinking, okay, I got to do A, B, C, D, you know, if I get into a problem. So there I am, where you see the video starting. And what I'm doing is we have these not intentional departure maneuvers, but we've had the, they were maneuvers to see if the airplane could stay in controlled flight. And okay. So we're doing those, and, it's just a left hard turn at 300 knots, you know, so you just turn left and max aft stick. And if the airplane stays in controlled flight during all these type of maneuvers, then okay, it's probably a good Cat 1 configuration is kind of the way it works out. That didn't happen, right? So I do that hard turn and the airplane departs violently, you know, a right slice across the sky, and it goes into a sustained 75 degree per second spin. And of course, I'm familiar with spins, right? I've done plenty of those in pilot training, and actually in test pilot school, we had a whole high AOA segment where we would spin A37s, you know, intentionally for a long time. So I knew I was in a spin. This is the unspinable F-16, so that was a problem.
Yeah. No joke. Slightly unsettling.
Slightly. It was a wild ride. I was holding onto the towel rack with my left hand because it was the wildest ride I'd ever been in an airplane. And so test conductor says, okay, start pitch rocking. And, you know, a lot of my buddies, as we're watching the video afterwards, are like, well, pitch rock what? You're going sideways. Why are you pitch rocking? And the way the airplane was spinning, it kind of this flat 75 degree per second spin, we called it the pinwheel. But I tried. I did three pitch rocks. It told me to hold, and I held down, and I did four more pitch rocks. And now I'm in seven full pitch rock cycles for an airplane that typically comes out after none or one pitch rock, right?
Yeah.
And I hit 25,000 feet, and that's when they called for the spin chute. And fortunately, the spin chute worked. And I popped that beauty, and the airplane just hung there in the chute in controlled flight. And everything's good. And once they saw my yaw rates and pitch rates had stabilized, they had me sever the chute. I come all the way. Engine worked fine. No compressor stalls or anything. We didn't know what caused it. They wanted to keep testing.
Yeah, naturally.
A few weeks later, another one of my buddies, Bob Wilson, went up, slightly different configuration. He had harm targeting system and asymmetric AMRAAMs. Same thing, exact same thing. Ended up in the pinwheel, ended up popping the chute. And so our program was shut down. And they said, yeah, go figure out what you're doing. And it took a while. We had one of our test pilots modeled it in MATLAB and figured out that it wasn't a yaw departure due to the asymmetric scores or anything like that. It was actually a moment from the engine. So the airplane's flying like this, and our engine's rotating like this, but it develops a moment, 90 degrees to your flight path. And that's what pulled me off in yaw, pulled us all off in yaw. And so all you had to do was pull the engine from mill power to idle power, and that moment greatly reduces. And once we did that, the airplane was easy to recover.
So the moment, I mean, being in mill power produced that much of a moment at that speed configuration as you went to pull that made you depart?
Yes. And they, you know, at the time, the procedures were to be in mill power for the best anti-stall logic for the engine. And I can attest this engine didn't stall.
Yeah. Engine's good.
G129, you could do just about anything with G129. It'll just keep on plugging through.
It's an amazing motor, but that's wild to me because not being a very smart guy, the fact that the motor being in mill power was enough to throw you in a departure.
That's what it was. Pretty amazing stuff.
You know, I joked about, I think it was Cinco. He was one of the first test pilots I had on this. I got some test pilot buddies. One who, you know, anytime something came up with the Dash 2, in fact, there's, listen, we got a massive manual with all the possible configurations, all the stores, and the limits change in the F-16. I mean, it's pilot induced for the most part. There's some stops you can do it, but it's, in my mind, it's really complicated. And there's lots of notes below that most pilots ignore or don't pay attention to, where the rules change as you drop or shoot things because the aerodynamics change, the weight changes, CG changes. And I can test, like, being in a Block 50 squadron, if you went around today, if you asked when the jet's 9G capable in a clean configuration with a HTS pod, you would get 100 different answers because everyone uses that spaghetti chart and they're like, below 6,500 pounds, below 6,900 pounds. Everyone has something different. So I was like, if we can't get that right, and when you start slinging AMRAAMs off of the jet, then no one knows. But again, it's a moot point if you're slinging AMRAAMs as far as that, you know?
Yeah, it is. And it's very complex. And yeah, there's probably some overgees, but...
What's an asymmetric overg?
Overgees aren't as much of a concern as, you know, you've got a set of scores that if you do enough maneuvering, you're going to work control flight. And if you do a low altitude, then... You know, you've only got a certain amount of time to get out because you won't be able to recover the control plane. So those are the warnings and cautions that end up in the dashboard after something like what I went through with the spin chute. That's how they get there. That's why they're there. And it's not always obvious to the average F-16 pilot who's flying the jet going, you know, it says I'm cat three here, but I'm just going to go to cat one and take my chances.
Right. Yeah, I mean, again, like you said, over G, not so much the concern. It's when you depart and do you have enough time to recover? Sure. I can't imagine spinning an F-16. Just that seems super uncomfortable.
It was uncomfortable.
Yeah. Did that modeling, I imagine that's how you determined that if you ejected in that spin there, it would not work out well with the canopy? Or is that done on a physical test? I know it wasn't with a pilot, but is there a way to test that? Or how do you determine that's a high threat region?
That was known from way back in the F-16, even the A models, when I was operational, they said, if you end up any kind of yaw rate, okay, you know, don't.
Yeah.
I imagine it was wind tunnel modeling, but we already knew that was kind of a fact by the time we were doing this testing.
I know you had mentioned too, and bio were kind of going back and forth there, but a couple engine failures while at TPS. Can you talk me through that? Because again, being in a single engine plane, when you lose your motor, it's a significant emotional event.
Yes, actually it was the same week as the spin chute. So that was interesting. So the first one, again, I'm in a small tail block 10, with Al Norman, who's actually the chief test pilot in Lockheed Martin Fort Worth now. And we're doing an IP upgrade for Al. And so it was just a high LA fan mission. So we're doing our first maneuver. We're going 60 degrees uphill, running it out of airspeed so we can get into a deep stall. And just as the airplane's stalling, the compressor stalled on the engine. And so you hear the talking and throttle, moving the throttle, nothing's happening. It's done, right? So we got sub idle RPM at like 50%. So pitch rock, get the airplane flying again, and then we walk through the air start, you know, shut the engine off, turn it back on. You know, you got to make sure the EPU's running, you want the JFS going, you know, all that stuff, making sure you have electrical flight controls. And it was pretty much a non-event because, you know, Al's pretty experienced guy. We came home, we landed, you know, the maintenance, I want to take a look at that. Maintenance signed off on, said, nothing wrong with the plane. You guys are just doing high AOA. Well, it never actually happens, almost never.
Yeah.
So we were suspect. 3 days later, same airplane, me in the back seat again. Now it's a Japanese test pilot, his very first F-16 flight ever. Perfect. So they'd come over for a week or two of test familiarization flights, for their airplane that they're developing. And, we put a centerline tank on so we could get more, you know, more stuff done. Right. Okay. So same plane, same thing happened, right? 60 degrees nose high, compressor stalled. Right. And I'm like, okay, I got it. I take the airplane. I pitch rock us, get us back into controlled flight, level off as we're gliding towards the lake bed at Edwards. I'm like, okay, we're going to have to do an air start here. So is the JFS on? And he says, yeah, but his English wasn't that great. So I don't know if the JFS was really on.
Yeah.
I can't see from the back seat. So I'm just like, okay. I asked him a couple times, as we're falling with satellite anchor, you're falling faster towards the ground. Okay. Is the EPU on? Yes. Okay. Really? Is the EPU really on? Well, yes. Okay. Well, leap of faith there. Let's shut the throttle off because he has to do that. So I talk him through that, restart it. And just about the time we were about to start our flame out landing, we got the engine going again. So we land. Both those flights are IFVs. They ended up finding the air data computer was faulty in that plane. Yeah. And Then a few days later, I had my spin chute. So it was my, and when, turns out when you pop the spin chute at Edwards, that's an in-flight emergency. So it was the engine. That's an in-flight emergency. So I came back after the spin chute, and my buddy of flight safety comes up to the plane and goes, "You might want to take some leave."
Yeah, maybe it's you.
3 IVs in a week. Maybe it's time for you to take some leave, bus.
And rather significant ones, you know, at that.
Yeah, that was it was memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. I bet. Landing on the dry lake bed in the Viper, I mean, you got nothing but runway. Is it anything different that landing on a concrete runway? I mean, to me, just unprepared surface. I know it's prepared, but it just seems wild.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple things. And we landed plenty in test pilot school in the T-38, no big deal. You just say, "Hey, I'm going to land on lakebed runway 34, right? And they go, "Okay, fine, clear to land." Your peripherals are very different because you have this enormous lakebed out of each side. And the runway is really wide because it's made that way for the space shuttle, or was made for the space shuttle. And so when the runway is really wide, human factors, you tend to flare high. So you had to fight that tendency. In the Viper, kind of the same issue. You want to make sure you didn't flare high. But the thing was with the Viper, because of the intake, we couldn't taxi off the runway. So the procedures were, if you land on the lake bed, you bring it to a stop, you shut it down, and you don't taxi, they'll tow it off.
Yeah, so I was wondering just with, I mean, I imagine like sand, dirt, and stuff like that has got to be going down that intake. And
not good for the engine.
Yeah, just not good. And that's what I've heard. F-35 wise right now, I know there's a couple engine issues, same issue, two different causes. But one of which, you know, some of them have been in the desert, you know, you're sucking down sand. I imagine that's turning into molten glass or whatever, and just doing some damage back there in the motor. Not a good thing for, any kind of engine.
Exactly.
Obviously a lot that happened there, being a test pilot, and I know you probably got a few more stories to share, but I wanted to say thanks for taking the time to join me on the podcast today. Truly fascinating stuff. And it's incredible work, because just the day, you know, I know that what you're working on in the 90s and probably early 2000s, that was showing up and being utilized, developing the tactics for what's going out there and doing today, which is pretty cool.
It is. It was really, really worthwhile to be part of a team that was developing all this capability for the warfighter and the future of the F-16. And even back then, we knew the F-16 would be around for a while. But back then, a while was 2025.
Yeah.
Now it's a little further down the road. But it's an amazing airplane. And from, you know, talking to guys, and I've listened to all your podcasts, and you have some amazing pilots that you've interviewed. It's really great to see the airplane is still very capable.
Yeah, it's an awesome plane. You know, who are the guys and gals who, you know, put that together and then funded it and made it happen, become a reality. You know, it's incredible. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, fond of it. Sir, thanks for taking the time to join me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rain. Really appreciate your time.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I enjoyed talking to Cranky. If you're looking for additional content, again, swing over to theafterburnpodcast.com. You can check out his spin video there. And if you're looking to support the podcast, don't forget to leave a rating or review over iTunes, or check out patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.